This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs. My guest this episode is executive coach Bill Cornwell. Bill has been coaching executives and working with executive teams for more than a decade. All in, he has upwards of 20 years of experience in Asia. In kicking off an interview, I like to ask what first brought my guest to Asia. In Bill's case, it was golf, or more precisely, golf courses. You're thinking golf pro, right? But no.
Well, it's really interesting. I've always been interested in traveling. I wanted to do more than live in Kansas, where I grew up, small farm community in Kansas. But I always felt there was a bigger, broader world to experience. And so I had moved to Houston, Texas, a number of different kind of positions, and then had the opportunity to look at being involved with a construction company in Singapore. And that construction company was in the golf course construction business. So I came over and investigated the possibility of joining them in November of 1994, and eventually came back in April of 1995. Not as a project manager, but the owner of the company asked me if I wanted to take over the company and run it for him. So I did that and had just a remarkable experience of traveling all over Asia Pacific, seeing beautiful pieces of property before they were developed into golf courses, and then certainly afterwards as we built them, what they did for the land and for the communities around them.
And this was a time when golf was starting to take off in Asia. There was this growing middle class. There was this desire for recreation. It had been there in Japan, but not necessarily in other parts of the region.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Steve. There was a pent-up demand. And initially in golf course construction, that pent-up demand is built on private golf courses to begin with, those ultra-rich environments where the developer had a piece of property, and they said, I'd like to get all my friends here to do that. So that was pretty much fulfilled from about 1992 to 95. A lot of that was taken care of. When I came over, what happened actually was the second phase of development of golf courses, and that was around a real estate play. So same piece of property by a wealthy owner, but what he wanted to do was build a property that had opportunities for primary land next to it, secondary and tertiary land, which were often homes. Small businesses would develop on the tertiary a little ways away to support all of the other things that were going on. In fact, we actually built a golf course between the north and south runways of the Jakarta Airport, which was called Taman Niaga originally, which meant business park. So they built businesses around the golf course so that they could entertain guests who came in to look at the products that they had. And so people were looking at ways which the golf course enhanced what was going on around them.
And that continues to some degree today, but in places like China, where there's been a crackdown on corruption, golf is actually out. And for people who are listening, what that means is that golf oftentimes was used as a business excuse to go out and shower your prospective clients or customers with lavish gifts and golf clubs and golf memberships. And when the government stepped in, this current government, they decided that maybe we need to curtail that. So there was a drop-off and a plummeting in China, but elsewhere in Asia, golf continues to be relatively popular, doesn't it?
Golf's very popular out here, and all statistics will tell us that it's going to continue to be popular. But there was a period of time when all of it stopped, and that was the result of the currency crisis of late 1997 and 98. Right. And what happened when the currency crisis hit, the golf courses no longer made sense for that growing middle class. Homes weren't going to be built because when your currency is devalued, the first place that it affects is real estate. And the last place to come back is real estate. So as an example, we were figuring building golf courses in Indonesia at about 2,850 rupiah to the US dollar. Almost overnight, it went to 16,000 to the US dollar. So nothing made sense anymore. So for me, it was an opportunity for me to reevaluate my career as I began to put that company in mothballs, basically.
And how did you reevaluate? And did you step directly into the world of coaching and leadership, or did you take a few side steps on the way there?
Well, I took a couple of side steps on the way there. One, I went into the restaurant business with a friend of mine, and it's always a great way to make a small fortune. You start off with a big fortune and get into the restaurant business. So I did that. It was a great experience because I was here in Singapore. And you learned about the difficulty of really running a great restaurant. Mm-hmm. These people have remarkable passion. And really the sensitivity to what makes a restaurant great. Enjoyed the business, but then I got out of it. And it was an opportunity for me just to stop for a moment and reevaluate my career and look for a single thread of something that connected all of the organizations was in, the corporations, the entrepreneurial experiences. And every one of them had the thread of people in it. And my desire to improve people in those companies. So,
explain that. Was there an experience that you had when you had the golf business where you saw that there were deficiencies or shortcomings with people and you saw opportunities to up the game by investing in them?
Yeah, great question. In the golf course business, I can give you examples of the project managers that I worked with. Who would come from the United States or from Australia and would be just immediately immersed in cultures which they didn't understand. So often they would try to do what they thought was best and just absolutely make a mess of it. So I would sit with them, talk with them about how to lead in that culture, how to understand how to ask someone from Indonesia how to do something, how to get them to do more than one thing at a time or to do the next thing when they finished it. So I enjoyed that.
So this is a bit of the cultural training, helping people understand how to be sensitized or empathetic to the way people viewed a particular problem or situation.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're on a golf course and you're asking a group of 10 Indonesians how to do something, you're wanting them to do something for you, you have to be able to explain it in a way, show them in a way that shows that you're sincere for them and to do it in the right way. Because if you just tell them what to do, they really will try to do their best, but it oftentimes is just it's not translated well, and you come back an hour later and nothing has happened. So that translation with the project managers was important because I would have 4 and 5 golf courses going on at one time around Asia, and so I couldn't get back to them, and they needed to know how to do that. I think earlier in my career, maybe even 30 years ago, when I was working in a certain business, I always wanted to grow people to the point where the only job that they could do was mine. And I would talk with them about, you're now ready to take my position, but I'm not ready to go. So let me introduce you to other organizations where you could. So I was always very helpful. Even if it meant I had a hole in my organization, I wanted them to keep going.
But that makes you different, Bill. Not every leader or manager does that. They're actually quite selfish and myopically focused on what they have to achieve and what they have to get. It must speak to something about your Kansas upbringing or your kind of good Midwestern values or something like that. What do you think?
Well, I think it is part of my values, but I also think that, look, if you have a team of people you're working with and other teams are looking at you, you have to ask yourself this question. Do I want to join a team where all of the direct reports have been there for 10 years? Or would I want to go work for a leader whose people are excited, they've moved out of the company, they've grown in other companies? Do I want to work for a leader like that? My answer is 100%. I want to work for a leader who's going to challenge me, who's going to help me grow, and doesn't stop me from my growth, whether it's in this company or in another company.
So you took these experiences, your personal direct experiences in running the golf business and maybe in restaurants, and then you applied it to some of the cultural anomalies or aspects of living and operating in Asia, and you came up with this idea that maybe I could apply these skills and these passions to help other organizations better manage and better lead in the region. Is that how it came about?
Well, I think that's ultimately was my thought process. What I originally said was, I think I know how to develop people. I know how to have a conversation with people. But what I didn't know was the specific processes for that to happen. How do you take somebody in development from A to Z? So the process of executive coaching, the process of leadership development, I knew I could stand up in front of people. I've done workshops before. But in this specific area, what are the nuances around that? So I had the opportunity to join an organization with that had been started by a very dear friend of mine. He asked me to join him. And I said, I want to get into the business, but on one condition, that you help me get certified in specific areas around coaching and around leadership. He was a master facilitator and facilitated with many organizations here in Singapore, maybe one of the best I've ever seen on stage. So he said, yeah, absolutely.
So then, and what was the organization that did you join? Was this CCL?
No, it wasn't CCL at that time. It was a company called Steve Morris Associates.
Oh, sure, of course, yeah. Okay, and that's how you got started, was with Steve.
Yeah, right. I got started with Steve, and he was just absolutely wonderful for me. I got my first certification in executive-level coaching was out of an organization based in England called Impact Creation Coaching, and their process was very rigid. You could absolutely see what you did in the first sessions and what you did in the second sessions and third and fourth and so on. And I fell in love with it. I absolutely fell in love with coaching and what it could do for people. And I felt strengthened by the structure.
So let's talk about that. For people who don't know what leadership consulting or coaching is about, if in a nutshell, how would you describe it as it relates to development in a corporate environment, for instance?
Well, great question again. I think the easiest way to describe it is executive level coaching is a person who can go in and analyze an individual through personality diagnostics, through diagnostics which will give you information about how they view change, how they like to work with teams. And then you take that information and you sit with the individual and talk about the context of their work. And then you marry the diagnostics with the context, and then you ask questions to get the development process through your coachee, because the change happens through the coachee.
So it's psychology for corporate leaders with a bit of a development twist. So the objective is different. Instead of trying to break down and understand what ails you, it's more about what could excel you.
Yeah, it's well put. It's I often will call it business therapy. It's therapy around what do you need to do to become better at what you do in the organization you're currently employed with. And when you ask that question, you get these answers, well, I don't really know. So my responsibility is to begin to pull that out of them and get them to understand what they need to do to think about developing to the next area, to be the kind of leader that their direct reports want and what they need from their leader. And the process, you know, continues for sometimes 6 months to a year. Some people I've been coaching for 4 years.
Yeah. And this is a relatively new industry in some ways, because for many years, the idea of the type A leader, Carnegie, you know, kind of developed, never's caught off, always knows the answers, powerful at every front, never shows the weakness. That's giving way a little bit to the idea of, no, being vulnerable, being a little bit inquisitive, opening up and delegating are actually more powerful and important attributes seen in leaders today.
Yeah, and Steve, the way you've just defined it would be to some degree the Western model of thinking about that type A. in relationship to this aggressive, always knows the answer kind of person. And there are certain aspects of that which translate or have translated to this part of the world. This part of the world, though, the leader is often looked as the Sifu, the intelligent one, the one who has wisdom. Therefore, you must tell me what I need to do because you're smarter than me.
So there's a deferral.
A deference to the leader, a great respect to the leader. I will tell you, though, that that's changing. And it's changing because organizations are moving at multiple times faster than ever before. Family businesses no longer have the luxury of believing that we can wait long enough for our kids to grow up, because now their kids maybe don't want to be in the business, but they've got to bring in more quickly professional talent that knows how to grow the company and get other people in the company to work effectively.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. When we come back, more from executive coach Bill Cornwell. Let's get back to my conversation with Bill Cornwell, executive coach. I've just asked Bill about the role an executive coach can play when a manager is brought in to help transform what has been essentially a family-run business.
When you bring someone in, and they're from the outside of the family, a coach can support them to sort of break apart what they need to think about as they're in this kind of environment. So the coaching from that aspect, it's multi-pronged, really. What does it mean to be in a family business? What is the family business doing? How do you begin to shift leadership so that it works in the family, but at the same time, bring them up to the modern requirement for the organization?
And I, you know, Bill, that's fascinating too, because if you think about the Asian family-run businesses, part of the onus is to keep things within the family. So even to bring somebody like you in from the outside to coach them and guide them on what they need to do or how they need to do it, in and of itself must have been quite an initial big leap for many of these organizations.
Yeah, it was a big leap. And even the view of coaching in this part of the world has changed. In the 16 years that I've been in the business, the first 5 or 6 years, coaching was looked at as a remedial issue. So I would never meet anybody in their office in the first 5 to 6 years.
It's private, you know, dark bars type of meetings.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was very private. A Starbucks or a coffee place somewhere, so that people didn't in the organization didn't know that I was being coached. Because if you were being coached, it meant that you're trying to stay in the company. Even if you were at a very senior level, it felt like there was something wrong with you. So we're getting you a coach.
It's interesting. When I was, I guess about 10 years ago, I was in a situation where I was told I needed a coach. And somebody actually assigned to me a coach. And I was told because I was having a hard time working with others. And I thought it was back in kindergarten. But I have to say, some of the kind of rules of engagement were wonderful and kind of eye-opening for me. But you're right. That it was always felt like a bit of a black dot on your record.
Yeah, and it was, you know, we often hear that when he doesn't play nice with other people in the organization.
Right.
But, you know, those folks often have risen very high because many of their decisions are absolutely correct. But when they get to a certain level, you can no longer push in that way anymore. Mm-hmm. And your decisions, though they may be right, are they the perfect answer for what needs to happen? So you have to learn how to be able to ask questions of others. What would you do in this situation? How else could we accomplish this activity? So the leader now needs to be able to get more information in. So back to the remedial coaching, about 7 or 8 years ago, that started to change. And I believe that the reason it started to change is because executive level coaching is expensive. So organizations began to say, why are we expending this amount of money on somebody who may not make it? And really, an executive coach can only do so much. There are reasons the person is not successful in the organization. We try our best, but often those reasons continue to exist, and long-term, they probably shouldn't be in the company. So when you take a look at the cost and the development, why not spend it on your high potentials? People who are already doing well, but may need to polish one or two areas. So as an example, back to what you said, you may not have played nice, but you are a remarkably strategic thinker on what we need to do next, a new product that could be done, a new way to restructure the organization. But you may have been telling people that's what they need to do. So I would come in and polish those things up, because the majority of what you did was right, and you can't lose that. Yeah. And senior leaders, owners of companies, conglomerates began to recognize, wow, let's just polish our high potentials, because then we have leaders that can do anything and can go anywhere. And then the return on investment is much easier to be able to ascertain.
Very interesting. So, you know, are these universal truths in your mind? Are these applicable across all cultures and all organizations? Or are there nuances from one market to the next?
Well, there are nuances, but much of what I do is similar throughout all of Asia. If I coach a leader in China, that leader is typically going to have the same kinds of struggles as someone in Singapore or Malaysia or even Indonesia. Now, some of the other younger developing companies, you're going to see coaching around levels of expertise. They just may not even know organizational structure the way that somebody else does. And so you have to kind of slow down and kind of build that into them. But it's a great question, Stephen. I'm often asked about, well, shouldn't you deal with the culture of the leader you're working with? And I would say, yeah, you have to understand the culture. You have to understand that that leaders in China have a natural tendency to say, I now am the leader. I've put up with everything, and now it's my chance to tell people what to do. But when they start to look upwards and outwards, you very quickly begin to recognize that the world is getting smaller around them, meaning that they're going to interconnect with leaders from all different types of cultures. So what does it mean to interact and lead in more of a universal kind of way? Here's the example. In Indonesia, when I first went there, there was always this issue of face. You know, you can't challenge a leader because you will take their face away from them. And that was something that we were cautioned about early when I was in the golf course business. And even for the first few years when I was in the coaching business. But then I recognized that I need to coach people, leaders, that if you're the kind of leader who believes in face, basically what you're saying is, I'm not strong enough to be challenged by my direct reports because I can hide behind my face.
And you pose that directly to them?
Directly to them.
Yeah. How did they respond to that?
Well, first off, they were uncomfortable because I hit what I knew was a truth, that this was a cultural way for me as a leader to kind of not deal with tough issues. And they absolutely knew it, because these people were, some of them were Indonesian leaders and trained at Harvard, you know, and all the best schools. They had master's degrees. So when they came back, they were kind of in that sort of, I'm the leader, but they had this out. Yeah. And it was face.
Did they apply that differently for Westerners who they were dealing with versus their own people from their own country?
No, it was the same.
Same way.
Yeah, because they would expect the leaders from foreign countries to recognize that I have my face here.
Right.
And so,
yeah.
So I said, you have to stop that.
And that's a tipping point. Once they break through and acknowledge, then there's actually access. And with access, there's an opportunity for change and development.
Exactly. And so what a coach does is he poses the question and and gets them to understand the uncomfortableness of what it would mean to do it in a different way. But then the coach doesn't just leave them there. You then ask, so how would you handle a challenge? What words would you say? So we would role play with them. I would challenge them on something, and we would role play around it. So a coach poses an issue and then helps them resolve how they would do it in a way which is authentic to them.
Yeah. And practical examples of where and how they could apply. Do you go that far? Is it theory?
Oh, no, it's practical. Yeah. It's practical because the coaching business has a saying, context is king. So in other words, the context of the work that you do, that's the most important thing. So we've got to understand that. So what are real life examples of how do you lead a meeting? What do you do when somebody says, I don't agree with you, boss? How do you handle that? And so we would talk specifically around that. When you're not meeting your strategy and somebody is not doing what they need to do, how do you handle that correctly?
Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks very much. I hope you can see how much I do enjoy this work that I do here in Asia. So thank you again.
Thank you, Bill. That was the first part of my conversation with executive coach Bill Cornwell. Bill will be back in a later episode with some stories of situations in Asia where executive coaching proved crucial in taking organizations to the next level. Watch for that and future episodes at www.insideasiapodcast.com. Or if you like, follow us on Facebook or LinkedIn. For now, let me leave you with a last thought, or what we like to call a bungkus, a kind of tasty takeaway rice meal a la Indonesia. This week, the topic is executive coaching. Is it necessary? Does it make a difference? Or most importantly, would you hire a coach to help sort through any number of personal and professional challenges that you might have? Historically, professional coaching has had a mixed reputation. For years, it was thought that people with quote-unquote issues were the ones assigned to coach or strong-armed into hiring a coach, or so the story went. But these days, coaching has evolved into a curious mix of art and science. Scores of new psychometric assessment tools have come to market that help drill down into the underlying behaviors that influence an individual's management or leadership style. A good coach draws from the results and then guides a client through a murky landscape where behaviors and actions tend to play themselves out. Ironically, the people who might be best served by professional coaching are oftentimes the ones who feel they don't need the help. Senior executives are especially prone to healthy egos. Who, me? My people love me. Well, you know the type. Bill reminds us that coaching can make a difference. Climbing the corporate ladder or building a new venture from scratch takes time, lots of time. So it's understandable that driven executives feel that time out for coaching just isn't part of the near-term plan. The more responsibility we take on, the busier we get. The busier we get, the more complex the agenda. And the more complex the agenda, well, go figure, the greater the need for coaching and grounded advice. Let me put it another way. As I'm recording this on a Sunday night, the lead story in the New York Times sports section is about a physiologist who's been studying the running mechanics of Usain Bolt. You know Bolt, the fastest man alive. As he nears the end of his track and field career, researchers are scrutinizing the thing that turned Bolt into the perfect sprinting machine, a gold medalist, in fact. Probably, researchers guess, it has something to do with his stride. But get this, Bolt's stride is uneven. Due to a childhood spinal condition, his left leg is slightly shorter than his right, which gives him a slightly lopsided, uneven running style. From a coaching perspective, it's a riddle. Actually, from a coaching perspective, it's a disaster. Ask any coach worth his or her mettle, and they'll tell you an uneven stride is a liability. Among other things, it's simply not efficient. It's something, thinking logically, that should probably be fixed unless, of course, your name is Usain Bolt. Could it be that the uneven stride is the secret to his sprinting success? Or is the opposite true? Could it be that Bolt never ran as fast as he might have because of his stride? That's the million-dollar question. Physiologists and track coaches alike don't know the answer, and maybe they never will. Maybe that's a good thing. Here's the point, and I suspect my guest Bill Cornwell would concur. Coaching isn't about fixing your problems. It's about making the most of what you have. We're all Usain Bolt. Some of us lean to the right, and some lean to the left. A few of us will even win gold medals. Learning to unlock the secrets of your own capabilities requires time and attention. So you're good at your job. Good for you. Now, how good could you really be? This is your million-dollar question. Think about it. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.